Hey everyone, welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm Sarah Century.
And I'm S.E. Fleenor, and today we are interviewing the one and only, the incredible Amy Chu. You might know Amy from Dark Horse Comics, Marvel Comics, DC Comics, Dynamite Comics, Lion Forge Comics, more and more comics all the time. She's written some of our favorite characters, Vampirella, Red Sonja, Deadpool, and the love of our lives, Poison Ivy. Thank you for being here today, Amy.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great. And if folks want to find you, Amy, where can they find you on social?
Yeah, social media. I'm mostly on Twitter, as much as I hate to say that. And it's easy because my name is so short. It's Amy Chu, right? A-M-Y-C-H-U. And then I'm also on Instagram. So it's Amy _ Chu. And also I have a website, which is also Amy Chu. Yeah. So
Amy Chu, and that will get you to where you need to go. So I'm a huge fan of yours. I want to say that I've been reading a ton of your stuff for a very long time, or I guess, you know, just like the last few years, but it feels like a long time because you've had a lot of really good runs. I read in an interview that you got into comics kind of via the fandom. Like, you worked in business and then you paired up with your friend Georgia Lee. Thank you so much. And who was one of the writers on The Expanse, right?
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
So I was reading through this interview and seeing kind of how you had gotten into fandom and stuff like that. And I think it's interesting that you became a writer kind of through that, like that introduction. And from what I understand, you didn't really read superhero comics that much before that. So I was just wondering, do you think that that gives you any kind of a different lens on comics, or how do you feel?
Sure.
About it?
Yeah, I don't think I'm that unusual. I take it back. I think I'm kind of unusual being a writer coming in that way. It's not like I wasn't into fandom, but, you know, like, I've been a huge Doctor Who, Star Trek, Star Wars, all that type of stuff for, you know, since I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
You know, which of course made me incredibly dateable in high school back in the day. I'm just joking. you know, I was on the chess team too. So yeah, I think the last girl asked to prom in my high school in the Midwest. Anyway, you know, I know fandom. It's just that I was never really in the comics group, you know, because it was mostly superheroes, mostly guys. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't want to imply that I didn't read comics. I did read, you're gonna laugh. I did read comics in college, you know, which is kind of later than a lot of people. But don't forget, I went to college at MIT, so everyone read comics at MIT, whether you're a guy or a girl, you know.
Right.
And it was, but by that time in college, there's comics for everyone. It's not just superhero. So the stuff that I was exposed to was a lot more the graphic novel. It was the Vertigo stuff, you know. So I did read comics. It's just that I didn't really consider it necessarily my thing or my destiny. You read comics because everyone else reads comics, just like everyone at MIT at that time were picking locks because somebody published their thesis on lock picking. So, you know.
You're just like painting this picture of yourself as like a street kid who's like reading comics and breaking into doors.
Yeah, so that was undergrad. And so again, this is terrible, but you go to a school like MIT where everyone's a geek, that's the norm. So it's kind of weird to sort of re-enter. I'm very comfortable in the comics world.
Mm-hmm.
But from where I come from, at least from the years I spent at MIT, you know, that was geekdom. And so for anyone to be like, you're such a poser coming in without having read comics, you know, you're a fake geek girl. I'm like, please, really? None of that stuff ever bothered me because I was just like, you are all fake geeks to me. So I did and I did not read comics. I certainly read comics simply because the guy I was dating at the time, who was an aero-astro major, and his buddy had a long box of comics. And that was the first time I'd ever seen a long box of comics, you know, and it was a summer and I was reading everything. And here's this long box of comics. And I just basically read through the whole long box. I'm like, oh my God, these are comics I have never, you know, I was suddenly exposed to comics that were non-superhero. They were so great. I just remember it vividly because I didn't really think of myself as a comics reader. I was just basically reading this guy's long box over the summer. And I never really bought comics again after that. And if you'll let me, I'm going to ramble a little bit here too, because it has a lot to do with my origin story and sort of coming into it. You mentioned my friend Georgia Lee, who basically dragged me into this whole thing. She wanted to write the comics. And I was like, yeah, I remember, you know, comics. I didn't really read them, but I read that guy's long box ages ago, and I really loved it. Sure, if you want to write comics, I'll help you out, right? So I didn't know that this is what would happen. I think she gets a kick out of it because she didn't know that this would ever happen. And nobody ever knew it happened because I have friends from MIT and Wellesley. I did a dual degree. So fast forward to I'm in Cambridge, right? And I'm doing my first signing and I'm getting people from MIT and Harvard. And lo and behold, one of my Wellesley friends stops by and she's like, what the hell, man? I didn't know you were into comics. I'm like, no, well, I wasn't really, but it's kind of by accident. But remember back, I was dating that guy, you know, back when we were dating those guys at MIT. And this guy had a long box. And she was like, that was my long box.
What a twist!
It was her comics the entire time. It was her comics the entire time. She was the comics fan. She lent the guys her long box that summer. So it was actually her comics the whole time. So I just thought that was really funny. And I think it's just instrumental in saying, you know, we have this preconception of who reads comics. Mm-hmm. She still reads comics. Her daughter also reads comics. Her husband basically picked up her pull list. He didn't really read comics. It was all for her. So, but she had good taste, obviously.
Oh, of course.
Are there any specific titles you remember from that long box that like you really liked?
Oh, I got to date myself. You know what? I was thinking so hard. Okay. And this was so all this stuff happened really right around 2011. It's long ago, but not that long ago, you know. Relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. So 2011, and I was trying to figure things out because I was like, 2011 is when I was like, I don't even know what's going on with my life. I'm suddenly in comics and I'm trying to make comics and I'm running around telling people I didn't really read comics. I didn't really know comics. But then I tell that story about that long box and I'm at my first industry event where, again, I had no idea what I was doing, but I was like, I really, really want to do this. And so I bought myself a seat for the Harvey Awards, you know, the Harvey Awards,
mm-hmm.
Yep. My thinking, of course, was that I'm new in this business. I don't know anybody. Where are all the professionals going to be? They're going to be in the ballroom at the Harvey Awards, right? So I must be where all these people are so I can learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize at that time, nobody does that, right? So, especially someone new, but anyway.
Right, right.
So this is another sort of anecdotal story, but it relates to this question.
No.
So I found out later that nobody does that, right? Especially just a single person and a single new person. Because when I walked up and I'm like, hi, you know, I signed up online. They gave me my table number. It was table one. It was table one. They put me at the head table because they didn't know what else to do with me. You have to understand, you know, the Harvey Awards are basically people are nominated. The publisher is supposed to buy a whole table for their crew. That's what happens, right? You don't just randomly walk in. So I'm like this odd person. They didn't know what else to do with me. So they stick me at the head table. So I sit down and I'm like, and everyone's looking at me like, who the hell are you? You know, in 2011, it's still not a whole lot of women either, right?
Right.
And I sit down, and then I am forced to tell my story once again. I'm like, yeah, I really got into comics. I was trying to help my friend. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I really love it. And yeah, I read comics in this long box. And they're like, ooh, exactly what you asked. What comics were they? Damn, now I'm on the hot seat here because, you know, it's so long ago. I had to really think because I really, really liked them. And I'm like, yeah, it was really like... You know, laugh. I finally remembered a lot of the comics in that long box were first comics. And I don't remember the specific titles, but you know, first comics back in the day was like American Flag and oh my God, now I'm going to forget. But anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm like, yeah, I was like, what the hell is that first comic? And they start cracking up because the guy who's really asking me all this stuff is Mike Gold.
Oh, yeah.
The publisher of First Comics.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sitting there because I'm like straining so hard. You know, I'm not making this up, right? And I'm like, what is the hell? It's like that guy, John something. And of course, Mike Grell, the creator, is sitting right across from me, you know? And so they thought that was such a hoot that they were always so nice to me after that. So, you know, when I talk about networking, I say, well, don't do as I do. But, you know, that is a true story. And that's kind of part of my origin in that it is helpful not to be a total fanboy or girl when it comes to stuff like that. But at the same time, you know, you get good stories like that.
That's a great story.
Anyway, so that was my long way of talking. Yeah. So you can't make that up. And to this day, Mike Gold has been so nice to me. He's like, anything I can do, you know, he's been very, very, very supportive because of that, I think.
Oh my God. I read that Poison Ivy was the first series that you wrote. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Oh, dear. That is, we are huge, huge Poison Ivy fans. And that series is one of the ones that's like one of the best stories with her.
Oh, yeah. Cycle of Life and Death is amazing.
It's so amazing. And so, I mean, we love her. So I was just kind of wondering what drew you to that character. Like, you know, how did you have a background of enjoying that character? Would you write her again? You know, all of that.
Oh, of course. All of the, but don't forget, this is not like something I have a say in. The matter, right?
Right.
As a new creator, you get what you're given, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was actually quite crazy that they were asking if I was interested in pitching for Poison Ivy. You know, at that time, everyone wanted to do Poison Ivy. So I was kind of like, is this some kind of mistake? You know? And I think it's even crazier how much people like that book, because it was my first book.
Yeah, that's what's so bonkers.
You know, I'm not even supposed to be writing. It's totally bonkers. It's like totally alternate universe that I got it, that I could write it. And it was very stressful writing that. And to have people like it so much, it's really mind-boggling. I mean, I'm happy, obviously, but it sort of raises the bar all of a sudden. It's like, wait, I'm not even supposed to be doing this. You know, can I still do this? I feel really insecure about it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, but then it turned out to be, I mean, for the people who I talk to about Poison Ivy, I think that that's one of the favorite stories. So, I mean,
I'm thrilled. But let's not forget, I mean, Poison Ivy is one of those characters that really, there hasn't been a lot of good material for Poison Ivy.
No, there has not.
So, I mean, I take it all with a grain of salt. I really, really love what I did with Clay on that. But at the same time, there wasn't a whole lot before, so.
Yeah, you had kind of a low basement, you know?
Right.
Yeah, you didn't open with, like, a graphic murder, so right there, doing good.
Right.
Doing solid, you know? I'm being sarcastic, but honestly, we totally adored that run. And, you know, I liked the Harley in it. I liked, you know, it's something that Sarah and I talk a lot about, Ivy and Harley, because why wouldn't we? And I just really loved how Ivy felt like the same person. And there's like this moment where she just sets this hard boundary with Harley, who can be like, you know, codependent as fuck. And it's just such a, like a refreshing moment, because even though it creates some tension between them and we see it resolved over the course of the run, it just is such a powerful moment, I think, for both characters and to move away from each other too, to do some of their own personal things. That's something Sarah and I constantly talk about, loving about those two characters. And I thought you were just like dead on it right there. And I don't know, I just loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think part of it too is I was trying to write from authenticity, right? Like, these are real relationships. I really hate the stories where you're like, that person would not do that. A lot of the other Poison Ivy stories, I don't want to like slam on people, but you know, like if I were Poison Ivy, I wouldn't do that. If you have all the power she has, why bother? I'm not going to kiss a guy.
Right.
I mean, who cares?
Exactly. Right. Like, what? Like, least of her powers.
Right.
For men? Like, for men.
Like, I would care if I were Poison Ivy. I got better things to do, you know? So that's the way I approached it.
But, like, you fuck with a dog or a plant?
Yeah. Mm-mm. Right.
And that, I was just like, that's my Ivy.
So that's being consistent to me. It's like you figure out, you know, because we were like, well, she's a villain. I'm like, no, she's got her own set of morality. If you were her, what would you do? That's what you would do, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that's so different compared to a lot of the approaches of Ivy. I mean, I think things are changing now and it's getting like a little bit more fleshed out. We'll see. You know, don't quote me on that, basically. But you did such a great job on that series. And of course, like, as I say, the characterization was so solid. So I really appreciate how you went on to do Red Sonja, who's also, to me, just equally iconic as somebody whose comics I was reading when I was really young. And Gail Simone did such a great version of Red Sonja. And I feel like your run on Red Sonja has just kind of taken everything that was, you know, that hit the mark in Gail Simone's run and just kind of built upon it.
Well, thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to do. Yeah.
Nailed it.
Because I was like, oh my God, Gail wrote this and now I got to write this. Very tough. Very tough. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a hard act to follow for sure.
I know. I wasn't trying to do what Gail did. I was literally trying to build off what she did because I can't write like Gail. She's got her own style, you know, as much as I would like to, you know. So it's respecting what she did, but trying to do my own take on it. You know,
I was going to say, I feel like that's why we read comics. I don't want to read the same thing. I like seeing how someone looks at another facet of the character, shines light on something I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. But like you were saying, they still have to be faithful to who the character is. And that's what I saw so much in your run coming out of after Gail, you know, like Red Sonja is so irresistible as a character because she's just so strong, so indefatigable, just like the bomb at every turn. But she also has all these other dimensions, right? Like she carries such a heavy load on her back and she cares so much about doing right by people. And it was so fun to see how you play with her and you know, taking her to different locations and, you know, bringing her to New York City and like letting her loose was like pretty freaking fun.
Thank you. You know, again, it's one of those things is like, well, you know, if you were Red Sonja, what would you do? You know, you'd be like walking around like stupid Conan, like what is this strange village? You know, like she's basically like, whatever.
Yeah. I'm in a different beer? Place now, I guess.
Yeah.
Beer. I'll take a beer. Thank you.
Well, again, if you were Red Sonja coming from the Hyborian age and, you know, you're presented with a cold beer, you're going to like it, I would assume.
Yeah. Also a higher alcohol content. You're probably going to feel that. Love that.
You know, the niceties of modern living.
Yeah.
When she takes a bath and she's like, yes, a bath. I get it now.
And that was obviously a play on Gail's, you know, whole Stinky Sonja run too. I just thought that would be, play a little bit with that. So. But yeah, I had no idea I would be writing as much Red Sonja as I did. I think they only asked me to do 6 issues. I really thought I was only going to do 6 issues.
Yeah, it seems like the first 6 issues do stand alone really well. But then it's like, as it keeps going, I think it just kind of gets better and better. It's been another one of those.
Thank you. I was like getting more and more insecure. I'm like, whoa, I was only supposed to do 6 and now it's 25. Right? It's like, where am I going?
Yeah, well, it seems like, honestly, you know, there's times where I just feel like people are constantly challenging themselves on, like, a character and kind of building from it. But that's how I always feel whenever I read the Red Sonja run. Also, now you're working with Eric Burnham, right?
Yeah, so that was actually, I'm so glad it worked out because I was really like, oh, my God. And at that time, too, I was working on so many different things because I was also working on Kiss and other things. And I'm going to reveal something that I haven't really talked about at all. And it is the deep-seated insecurity of being a writer, but also being, as you know, like I never thought I was going to be a writer. And here I am doing this iconic character. And I always struggled. You know, I don't have a problem. It's not like I'm trying to be coy or anything or downplay because I know I'm good at pacing and story and characterization. My whole thing with Red Sonja was her crew, you know, like she's in New York. She's going to need allies. You know, this is my opportunity to build that colorful supporting cast, you know, and it's also my opportunity to bring in a librarian. I always wanted to put in a librarian, you know, badass tattooed librarian into a series, right? So I got all that down. But the one thing, which I never even discussed with Dynamite, but I was just like, this is the hardest part. I could never really figure out Red Sonja's voice. Her dialogue, when I wrote it, just never seemed right. And I had met Eric Burnham before at multiple conventions, really great guy. But he is, in my opinion, way better with that kind of dialogue than I am. And so I'm like, you know, can we do this? You know, I'll do the first pass and then you do, you know, you basically will co-write together. So that's how that came about. And thank God for that, because that was, I forgot when he started, but so he was instrumental in several issues after the first arc doing that. So that's the backstory of all that.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased with how it turned out. And I'm really happy that people enjoy that run, because that's what it's meant for. I mean, it's entertainment. It's meant to, it's escapism, but hopefully sort of smart escapism. Like I said, it was my opportunity. I feel good that whenever I can get a PhD into a story, that's what I'm aiming for. You know, I did that with Poison Ivy. I'm like, okay, where can I fit? You know, female PhD. Okay. The librarian.
Yeah. Pretty recently, I think we did a comic of the week where we just kind of raved about how much we love Red Sonja meets Vamprilla meets Betty and Veronica. How did that series come to be? Because I feel like a lot of people were like, that's the most bonkers concept I've ever heard. And I was like, it is, but it's, I'm sure it's going to be great. So I was with that series from like day one.
Oh my God. Thank you. Yeah.
Of course.
It's terrifying, you know, because every time it's like, what have I done to my life? You know, so Red Sonja, I really love Red Sonja, but at the same time, it's like, I'm not sure where am I going, you know, as a writer. And it was their idea, first of all. Dynamite came up with a crossover and they're like, hey, do you want to write this? And I'm like, are you crazy? I didn't say that. That was my thought balloon. You know, they brought it up like, why the hell would these characters ever be together? And of course, I didn't say that. You know, I was very polite and I thought about it. And I was like, I should say no because, you know, if it's bad, it's going to be bad. But at the same time, I was like, well, that is so bonkers. If I can actually come up with a story, then I feel like I did my own self-hazing and then I'm legitimately a writer. So
you were trying to haze yourself.
I was. If I can do this, that means I really truly am a writer.
Oh man.
That's really how it came about. So I gotta say,
yeah, it's like the most beautiful hazing I've ever seen the results of. You know, like I don't usually experience post-hazing to be such an awesome and fun experience.
I am so happy because I was like, I think I can make this work, you know? And then, you know.
It feels like it was almost like, it's like when you're making really good stew. It's like you have to put more ingredients in than you think, but you have to have them the right amount. And you really nailed it with this. And I think it's nice too how you balance it across the different arcs, you know? And I don't know. I was like, Sarah, I don't know about this. And she was like, yes, you do, because I'm telling you to read it. And I was like, you know what? Good point. You are Sarah. And I loved every second. It was like totally Riverdale, and it was totally Betty and Veronica, and it was somehow totally Red Sonja and Vampirella if they were in Riverdale. And I thought there were so many funny resonances with the TV show and how, you know, all these like children look like they're 40 and then like Red Sonja and Vampirella walk in and they're like, we're children, we're just large because we're European. That's so funny.
Well, thank you. That was the hardest part. It's the balance, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why I wanted to do it. It's like, you know, if I can do this and show that I can write a team book, you know, that's so crazy, but still works. That means I can do this for other things too, hopefully. But I got to say, it is really hard. It's probably the hardest series I've ever written. And especially now, I just turned in the last issue. So it hasn't been drawn yet. But, you know, I get so nervous. I'm like, oh, my God, I hope this works. I hope it pulls off because it's I try to plan these things. As you know, I like a good reveal.
Yes.
Yeah. So hopefully you're not disappointed. But and of course, you know, the main thing is like I got to get Betty or Veronica to Dracula. That was my whole thing. It's like that would be hilarious.
I know. See, oh man, as a longtime Vamprilla fan, I was losing my mind whenever it was like, and now we have to go to Draculon. And I was like, what?
Because why not? You know, where else do we go?
Exactly.
You don't want to stick around Riverdale anymore. Where would you, you know, why not go to Draculon though?
Yeah, if you're going to keep upping the ante, you got to keep upping the ante. And you did by going to Draculon.
There we go. My only regret, if I had more issues, I would have them spend more time in space. That's the only thing I would have liked to do, because we haven't seen a lot of Betty and Veronica in space.
That's right.
Almost nothing, in fact. So why not? But that's like a whole nother series. So
I was like, I'm seeing a series right there. Betty and Veronica in space. I'd read it.
Right. Betty and Veronica and Battlestar Galactica. You know, I mean, there's a lot of opportunities. A lot of opportunities.
Oh, and because they're both reporters, they have such distinct decades and decades of history as characters. You can do ridiculous shit with them and it works.
Yeah. It's what is it? It's the willing suspension of disbelief. We already know these characters. I don't need to kill anybody. I don't need to do anything. It's, you know, but stick to the true nature of their character is very important.
Yes. Well, that is the best. And that's why I think a lot of these comics are so fun for people like me who have been reading these characters for such a long time to be able to jump in and read somebody who's keeping it consistent and kind of introducing, you know, new things that aren't discordant, I guess. I also want to talk to you about Green Hornet, because that's another series that is so just kind of like, what?
Thank you.
I like Green Hornet? Amy, you made me like Green Hornet.
I really wish, you know, that's the other regret. I really, really enjoyed writing Green Hornet. I just wish more people would have bought it.
Right.
You know, if they had, I probably would have gotten one more arc out of it, and that would have been great. But who knows? Who knows? But I really had fun with that series.
I think I was listening to maybe a sci-fi interview with you, and it was just kind of you talking about how Green Hornet has been around forever, just as long as Superman, basically, and hasn't really caught the public consciousness as much. And I think that you went into Green Hornet telling an iconic story to be like, what's up? Like, this is Green Hornet. And I think that that's why it works so well, you know, like as a reader, it works really, really well.
He's richer in a lot of ways. He's got a lot of more cool stuff. And he's older. Is he older? I think so.
Yeah. I mean, he's drawn like a little bit older. Yeah.
I know. I should know these
things. And he's got like his anti-hero thing, you know, like a little like anti-hero, mysterious, balancing good and evil. Like that's everything we love in comics.
Right. And there's a lot of old school stuff about Green Hornet that makes it very attractive to write that whole franchise. I did some research. I am not the first woman to write Green Hornet, but I'm definitely the first woman to write the series. So, of course, I have to do that because I'm like, well, why not? But I feel like it's such a disservice not to write a good story with that character. But also, it's my opportunity because Green Hornet was really popular. My parents are from Hong Kong, you know, so they know Green Hornet from the 60s. And so that whole generation, because of Bruce Lee and Kato, you know, it's like, this is my opportunity to actually write something they may actually want to read.
Yeah. Did they read it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. They're very Chinese parents in that way. It's kind of like, you don't really know. Do they think what I'm doing is weird, or are they proud of me? I'm not really sure. So that's why I was like, Green Hornet, you know what? If I make Green Hornet Kato's daughter, you know, we put some badass martial arts and we take some of the action to Hong Kong. You know, so there's a theme. I really like to change up the environment to cool places, and let's do part of the story in Hong Kong. We'll set some of the action in Hong Kong, you know, which is a lot of fun for me. And that's the great thing about working with Dynamite is they just let me do stuff like that. We're like, yes, and we're going to go to Istanbul, and then we're going to go to Hong Kong. You're like, oh, okay, fantastic. You know, I get to do things like that. So it was a lot of fun. So I hope more people read it, you know.
Yes, same. We'll do that as a comic of the week soon, too.
Oh, for sure.
So also, I noticed that you have some creator-owned work that actually I haven't read. So I was looking through your bibliography and just kind of trying to figure out all of the different things that you've written. And this was how I discovered that Poison Ivy was your first series. But I was just curious about some of that, because I saw that you had started even a publishing company. And is that still going? Or
well, sort of. I mean, so we've gone way off my business plan, you know, that company right. was what I started with Georgia back in the day. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be, she would write and I would publish.
Yeah.
And somehow that turned into me writing. and those are the self-published stories that, because it's almost impossible to so-called break in to comics. I just say, hey, I want to write Poison Ivy. It doesn't work that way. You have to have done something before, which typically means you got to self-publish. And that's exactly what I did. So I just ended up self-publishing multiple stories just to again, try to prove my writing chops and that I could write any kind of story. And I guess it worked.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, seems like it worked out pretty well.
I feel like we're missing a link between two moments in time. Okay, we've got the time of Georgia, and you're supporting her. She's going to do the writing. And then you write these creator-owned. What happened in there? What did you do?
So I lost a couple years of my life, basically. It was literally like that. When I think back on it, it's kind of like, you know, it's like when you have kids, you kind of erase that, the pain of childbirth, that, like, you know, so you can have another one kind of thing. It's the same thing where I sort of lost, I lost a couple years of my life where I don't even know what happened because I went so, you know, it's like Apocalypse Now. I went so far down the river, so deep in the jungle. I'm like, how hard can this be? You know, it's a business. You write, I'll figure out, you know, we get artists, we do all that stuff. I went to my first comic convention, which was actually, I think it was C2E2. We went there and walking around, I'm like, oh my God, this is like a whole nother world. I didn't even know. Went from that to Georgia saying, okay, so we're in, right? We're going to do this. And she basically got me to sign up for an online writing class. And this was 2011. This is my missing year, 2011. I signed up for this online writing class where I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, it's like, I'll do it. But needless to say, I was the only woman in the class. The rest of the class were a bunch of dudes who immediately started arguing about Martian Manhunter or something like that, where I'm like thinking, I don't even know who the hell Martian Manhunter is. I had to Wikipedia every single character. And don't forget, 2011, I got two small kids too. So not only am I the only woman, I got two kids crawling all over me and I didn't know who Martian Manhunter was. How could I possibly be a comics writer or fan? So that's kind of how my 2011 started. And it really kind of became a chip on my shoulder that I was like, I don't see what Martian Manhunter has to do with anything about writing comics, right? So I wrote my first story, not necessarily to prove anything, but just because that's the class, you write a script.
Right, right.
And I wrote the script. I'm sort of cutting out a lot of stuff here. And I'm still friends with a lot of guys. I'm not trying to be, but you know this, that situation, right?
The podcast is called Bitches on Comics. We are with you. We are with you.
The assignment is to write a 5-page script and to write a 5-page script and turn it in on time. And so, of course, I do that because I'm a student. I've done that before. I turned it in, and I would say a good half of them didn't turn it in, or they turned it in, but like, I can't do it 5 pages. It needs to be 10 pages. I couldn't. You know what I mean? It's like that.
Yep.
The assignment is to write a 5-page script, and I did it.
Right.
And lo and behold, the instructor, who's an ex-Marvel editor, was like, hey, let's talk about Amy's script. It's really good. Like, what? No. I write PowerPoint. I'm not really here for me. I'm here to help my friend. And that's how it started. Because once you have that taste of somebody reading your stuff that is not a business PowerPoint and saying, oh, I really like the reveal. Nobody ever says that in a business meeting. Like, wow, that really moved me. You know? That pie chart was so elegant. You know, nobody ever says that.
The bar graph really moved me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I got really sort of swept up in the whole thing where I'm like, wow, I can actually write and people like it. They find it funny or they're moved or whatever. It's kind of intoxicating. So I literally spent the entire of 2011 just learning craft. I was like, I got to learn a letter. I even took an art class because I was like, well, I need to understand how the artists think, you know, so I can write scripts better. And I learned to color too. So I can actually kind of flat in letter. Basically, the whole end game by the end of 2011 was still very much Georgia would write the stories and I will do everything else. And so 2012. And we also wanted to do comics that actually had featured women without flashing cleavage. You know, you would think this is apparently groundbreaking for 2011. But it was because our first convention, here we are peddling our comics with a woman who is not showing cleavage. And we got plenty of people commenting on that. I'm like, okay, this is sad. sad state. Yeah. That, you know, you're saying that. Even now, it's still kind of difficult.
Right.
But anyway, so that 2011, don't even know what happened. But we produced our first comic called Meridian City. And she wrote the script. And I didn't draw it, of course, but I found all the artists. I even lettered it myself. But like I said, you go so far down that path where I actually printed it 3 times because I just kept getting better and better. I wanted to do a better job on each version. So
that's such a good metaphor for writing, right? Like, you can never write anything as good as your craft is because you're constantly getting better as a writer. Mm-hmm. And Sarah and I both write fiction. And so it's just like so exciting to get to talk to someone who, you know, I just love how you share that you're nervous and we're nervous and still are nervous. And it's like, I'm fucking nervous all the time.
Like, all the time.
You can be nervous.
Every morning I wake up and I'm like, what the hell am I doing? Is what I'm doing any good? So, you know, and someday somebody's going to figure out that I'm a complete fraud. It's true. I feel that all the time. And logically, I know, you know, I've written enough by now that I should know that it's okay, but I still feel like that. So there you go.
No, I really, really relate to that. Sarah and I talk a lot about different parts of like the creative process. We're also publishing a fiction anthology in June. We're doing a Pride related fiction anthology. We're very excited. And part of like what we're trying to encourage people to do is just like submit, let somebody else read your work. Just, you have to, you know, you're never going to know how well it is or isn't working if you don't expose yourself to an audience.
Right, right.
Hey, so it's May right now, but soon it's going to be June, and June is Pride Month, and
what?
We are going to do, I don't mean to blow anybody's mind, but that is what we reserve June for, is drinking vodka at like 9 o'clock in the morning. It's mixed with cranberry juice and really hot, and then you stand in the sun until you get exposure, but you're happy about it, and that's what Pride is like, so... For this Pride, we're independent artists, independent creators, and we want to support independent creators and people who want to read stuff that is by independent queer creators as opposed to being corporatized, which is unfortunately another aspect of Pride. So it'll be really great and really fun. You can get a subscription right now until May 17th for $12, which is cheaper than the price that will be after May 17th, which is $15, which is still pretty good, but... You want to save a few bones, then you can.
Absolutely. That's 30 stories. 30 stories for either $12 or $15. And by stories, we mean comics, flash fiction, short stories, long form short stories. All of the stories will also have a cool art element done by our one and only Sarah Century. It is going to be such a cool program, and we really want you to come join us. It's decodedpride.com.
So 2011, I was like, I spent all that time learning. 2012 and 2013, I started writing all these short stories. And there's a certain point where you do need support, you do need an audience, but you also sometimes need to distance yourself from, I would say, like people who, some of it is just plain old taste, you know? And I find that when you're a woman, and it's mostly guys, all the guys seem to want to tell you how to do things. And I know this from experience at MIT, too, that, you know, when you're in a study group and you're the only woman, everyone else has the right answer except you, you know, and even though you have the right answer. And it's the same thing in comics. Or after a while, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do as I do. You know, I don't need you to critique my script. We'll just let the readers decide, you know, and I think that worked out for the best. And that's part of the reason I self-published, you know. People like my stuff, they'll like my stuff. Yeah, so it was great. It was hard, actually. But that, of course, eventually led to my first DC. So I got a little, you know, this was exciting, of course. You know, and it's a shame that people still don't do more anthologies. But that's really how you break in. And I finally got my big break in a Vertigo anthology. Like a lot of people, I'm in the CMYK quarterly with Tom King. You know, there's a whole bunch of people. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say we're the same generation, but you know what I mean? It's like, you know, That's the opportunity to get published and show off our writing chops. And, you know, that was huge, you know, and that could have been my only story. Truthfully, that could have been my only story ever published. And I would have gone back to self-publishing. But, you know, I got more stuff and I got even more stuff after that. And it was great. It was good.
Where do you think that you want to go after this? Because you said that you're wrapping Red Sonja and Vamprilla meets Betty and Veronica. And yeah, so what series will you be working on next?
Oh, I don't know. Especially now. My only goal, honestly, is to clear all this stuff off my plate so I can actually play some video games. I haven't done that since like 2011.
Right.
You know, it's literally, I'd like to get back to actually.
They can't have changed that much in 9 years, you know? They're probably the same.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend in my bubble. I'm just going to catch up on all the games I missed out during that time. That would be seriously nice. But you know, in this business, part of it is the opportunity, but also definitely want to get back to creator-owned, absolutely. But that's also fraught. The thing with licensed or work for hire is I like working with constraints. I like somebody giving me a crappy character that people have done wrong by and letting me fix that character. Mm. And of course, usually that's a female character. So I like it. Before I was in comics, I'm what is sort of called as like a turnaround consultant. Like, your business is failing, I'm the one that goes in and fixes it. You know, I had to troubleshoot and figure out and come up with a new business plan. It's the same thing with comics. You know, you give me some crappy character. I shouldn't say crappy, but you know what I mean.
Some characters that have not been used as well as they could
be. Exactly. That's a nicer way of saying it. And then I think about it, I come up with a strategy. It's like, yeah, no, this character has been done wrong because of this. Let's try to fix that. And that's kind of how I approach it. So I like that. I like it a lot because I feel like fandom appreciates that. Green Hornet, there's nothing that makes me happier to have one of those Green Hornet fans. And you know what I'm talking about? They grew up with Green Hornet. They've gotten really crotchety because Green Hornet has been done so poorly, you know, right, by the fan base. Mm-hmm. And they always come up with like, okay, I was not going to like your run because I could already tell I was going to hate your run, but I gave it a shot. And it's really good. And then they walk away. I love that. It makes up for everything. I would rather have that than have it sell gangbusters and not have that, because it says to me that I did figure it out and understood, you know, what the character was about.
Yeah.
I still get somebody like that. Every convention, they sort of come up, they're kind of timid. They're usually in their 50s. And they're like, yeah, I was a Green Hornet fan and, you know, it was good.
Not your parents yet, but they might.
They might at some point. My dad will write a very lengthy email, as he does, dissecting it.
Of course.
He's never going to listen to this podcast, so. Nope.
Yeah, not too worried about that.
Not worried.
Yeah.
It's going to turn out that he's on every episode, like, listening. Oh, man.
Well, who knows? Because as it turned out, his dad in Hong Kong, nobody tells me these things because, you know, like, I, for, you know, 2011 and 12, I was not telling my parents I was doing all this. They had no idea until I started getting stuff published years later. And when that happened, I was like, oh, I don't know how they're going to take it. You know, it's like I'm coming out. It's like, I don't know how to break it to you guys, but I'm now a comics writer. So it turns out somebody let the cat out of the bag and told my grandmother. And so my grandmother was like, so I hear you're writing comics. I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. Who told you? And it turned out that my grandfather was a huge DC fan since the 50s. Nobody bothered to tell me that he had squirreled away a huge collection in a safe, not for the kids, but for himself. And so there's that.
Did he read any of your comics?
No, he passed away a long time ago. Mm. So again, I guess people didn't really feel the need to ever bring that up.
Oh, like, my gosh. Okay.
That would help me in any way. Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway, so I assume, you know, in the afterlife somewhere, he's really having a good time seeing how this panned out, you know.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, I would be super stoked in his shoes. Like, yeah, go Amy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, being Chinese American, Asian American, for a lot of us, we're really sort of like, no, you need a real job, be a computer programmer, be a doctor, be, you know, nobody ever was like, you know, I'm like 10 years old and say, hey, have you ever thought about being a comic book writer? You know, that is not the career path ever that is brought up. So I'm just glad it all worked out.
Yeah, I would say it has. This has been just absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for your time. I don't know, Sarah, do you have any other questions?
Yeah, I was just going to go ahead and wrap it up. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Amy?
Oh, no, I feel like I rambled. I hope that, you know, I sort of talked about the cool stuff that I need to talk about. I don't know.
I laughed so hard I cried at least twice, so I think we're good. I think you nailed it.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, if we start setting rules on rambling on this podcast, I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah, like, Sarah and I will both be fired by ourselves.
Yeah, we're getting fired, definitely.
Our sound engineer will stay.
Yeah, no, this was lovely. As I say, I'm a huge fan of your work. I think that your run on Red Sonja and Gail Simone's also are the things that kind of made me be like, you know, I've been reading this character forever. Those are the runs where I'm like, I can hand this to other people and like have them read it because, you know, there's like some of that. It's been so great to read your stuff. And I look forward to whatever it is that you end up doing, Jughead and Red Sonja and Betty and Veronica in Space. They all sound really great. So just, yeah, thank you so much. And go ahead and follow Amy on everything. Yeah, because,
go ahead and
of
follow
course.
Me on everything. I'm still experimenting because there's so much out there. But for the most part, you know, I also have the, because a lot of people can't necessarily remember, but my website, I also have iwritecomics.com because I frequently get confused with being an artist and I'm not an artist. So iwritecomics.com is mine.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thank you. Yeah.
Clever.
Yes. So,
and you know, I just realized it's like super funny because I think we talked about how feminist your work is through specific examples, but obviously thank you for creating works that are so deeply feminist that we can actually as comic readers just relax and read it and know that nothing horrific, nothing terrible, nothing anti-woman, nothing anti-queer, nothing anti-non-binary, you know, right. We're not going to be exposed to abject hatred. And unfortunately, that's not always a guarantee when we open comics.
Oh,
so
for
thank
sure.
You.
No, but you know, thank you. If I may say, I feel like it's really funny and I'm glad you bring it up because I can't tell you how many readers come up to me at certain conventions, and I'm talking about mostly guys who are like, I loved your stuff. I am so glad you're not like one of those crazy feminists. And I'm like, did you read the comic? They're
right,
like,
right.
You nailed Red Sonja, strong female, not like these crazy social justice warriors. I'm like, did you read the comic? It's crazy. I don't know. Anyway, I have a good laugh. I'm happy they enjoyed it. Clearly, there is some disconnect here, but, you know.
Because Red Sonja isn't organizing, like, the Women's March, then, like, they just...
Yeah, what they confuse things with is she's obviously very, she got a lot of boobage, right? You know, she's flying around, and they figure because I didn't want to basically put more clothes on her, I must not be a feminist, which,
right,
you know, and that's not the same thing. But the truth is, no. I did try to put more clothes on her because I was like, wow, that is not a lot. You cannot walk around New York like that. You cannot walk around.
In a snowstorm?
Well, the story about the snowstorm is that wasn't in the script. Oh. I was like, crap, Carlos, you know, he's drawing her beautifully and beautifully sexually, but I'm like, that is not going to work. So I was like, Carlos, I forgot to tell you it's winter and there's snow coming down, so she's going to need a jacket. So that's kind of how I handled that. But.
And Sarah and I, we've done whole episodes talking about, like, women should wear whatever women want to wear.
Right. She can wear whatever she wants to wear.
Yeah. But also, like, if it's winter and cold, maybe she should put a coat on because, you know, she doesn't have ice skin or whatever the hell you might make it where you didn't have to.
She's tough, but, you know, again, it's not going to work in New York. Maybe it'll work in L.A. if we were in L.A., but she's in New York, and it's a bit of a distraction, so let's... And that's how I got the motorcycle, too, because I was like, you know what?
Yes.
First of all, it's badass that she rides a motorcycle.
Oh, yes, so yes. Cool.
So, like, she cannot ride a motorcycle, you know, with a chainmail bikini, a scale mail bikini. She's going to need pants now. Carlos, you're going to have to put her in pants.
But it was also pretty funny in Red Sonja and Vampirella Meet Betty and Veronica when she's like, don't wear pants. I don't. I died. I was like, Red Sonja.
Yeah, because that's what she would say.
Totally.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah. In that series, almost specifically, like, her voice comes across really well because it's contrast to all of the other characters.
Well, so it's funny. I found it easier. I told you I was having trouble writing Red Sonja's voice in the other series. But I found it much easier to write in the crossover because exactly that. In contrast, it's a lot easier to have her voice in response to everyone else's.
Right.
So. Well, that makes sense. Those extreme contrasts can make things easier to do. Well, you know what? Thanks for doing a little epilogue. That was really great. Thank you so much, Amy. I am just like grinning ear to ear. I am so happy that we had you on the show. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, this is so much fun.
We're a podcast that is all about making comic books more accessible to LGBTQ folks and women. So if you have a question about anything related to comics, comic adaptations, pop culture in general, conventions, cosplay, you name it, that's what we're here for. You can send us your questions at bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. Unfortunately, Gmail does not like the word bitch. They're pretty judgy about it. So we can't have it spelled out. It is bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. And do you remember, there's no I in bitch.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm S.E. Fleenor. You can learn more about me at sefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.